Welcome to the Legally Speaking Podcast. You are now listening to season 7 of the show. I'm your host, Rob Hanna. I've got some exciting news for you. Legally Speaking Podcast is hitting the road and heading to ClioCon 2023 in Nashville from October the 9th to the 10th. Imagine 2 days jam-packed with game-changing insights, networking opportunities, and the chance to connect with legal minds from around the globe. Whether you're an attorney, paralegal, or just someone passionate about the world of law, this conference is for you. So mark your calendars and join us at ClioCon 2023 and see you in Nashville. This week, I'm delighted to be joined by Shainul Kazam. Shainul trained as a lawyer at Memory Crystal, where she qualified into the corporate department. There, she specialized in corporate finance and flotations. In 2004, Shainul launched Fortune Law, and at the time, she was the youngest female to start a solo law firm in the UK. Fortune Law has grown out its expertise from corporate finance now into intellectual property, commercial property, employment, and dispute resolution services. Shainul is an honorary practice fellow of Imperial College London, teaching her own Law for Entrepreneurs course on the Executive MBA. Shainul regularly appears on TV and radio. She was also shortlisted for the We Are City Rising Star Awards in 2017, the National Diversity Award Entrepreneur of Excellence in 2017, and was a finalist for the Best Professional in Business at the London Asian Business Awards 2019, and most recently, Fortune Law won Boutique Law Firm of the Year at the Modern Law Awards 2023. So, a very warm welcome, Shainul.
Hello, Rob. Lovely to see you.
Lovely to see you too, and thank you so much for joining us. And before we dive into all your amazing work, your projects, your experiences, we do have a customary icebreaker question here on the Legally Speaking Podcast, which is, on the scale of 1 to 10, 10 being very real, what would you rate the hit TV series Suits in terms of its reality of the law, if you've seen it, on the scale of 1 to 10?
Oh, reality of the law. You know, I think Aaron Korsh actually based Harvey Specter a little bit on me, you see, because I'm an M&A lawyer and I also get involved in litigation. Sometimes on the same day, I box and I also have a very nice fireplace. I think that some firms have someone who's a little bit like Lewis Litt. I think paralegals are the backbone of any law firm, including mine. And so I'd probably give it a 8 out of 10 because, well, Mike.
Yeah, absolutely. And what a great answer. And I love how you've kind of gone through all the characters and you're a Harvey equivalent. I'm loving that. So 8 is justified. And with that, we'll move swiftly on to talk all about you. So to begin with, would you mind telling our listeners a bit more about your sort of background and career journey?
Okay. So not a lot of people know this, but I was born in Tanzania in East Africa. And I came here with my older sister to live with my grandparents when I was 5 years old. And the reason that we did that was because it was becoming politically unstable in Tanzania, and our businesses were becoming nationalized. So, you know, my parents would go to work, you know, they were entrepreneurs, they would go to work and they might find that, they, you know, there were chains across the door and the business had been taken by the government, and then they would have to start again. And so they did that a few times. And then, you know, they felt like it was safer for us to be out of the country. So we came quite late to the UK because my parents had held on for quite a while, not wanting to leave. And I don't know if you know, but many Asians left East Africa in the 1960s and the 1970s, primarily from Kenya and Uganda in what was now called the Exodus. And so that was because of a result of a process called Africanization. And so Idi Amin in Uganda, for example, expelled many, many Asians, including some of my family members. And so many of them had British passports. And so therefore they arrived in the UK and many went to Canada, for example, as well. So these were sort of coming back from a family which are called twice immigrants. So moving from India to Africa and then moving from Africa to the UK. And so that's where, you know, I arrived here age 5, didn't speak a word of English. Spoke Swahili, but now the only Swahili I know is, you know, what everybody else knows from The Lion King, and that's about it. And so the 70s were pretty challenging, I think, for my parents. You know, it's an interesting time, but it's also, you know, a worrying, a traumatic time. And so although we had significant businesses in Africa, when we got here, we literally came with nothing. So, you know, I watched my parents work very hard to raise, I'm one of 3 girls, I'm the middle child, tricky middle child. And so they were, you know, they didn't speak the language, but my father didn't. And, you know, they built successful businesses. They raised three girls and they were hands-on parents. And they really prioritized education. And I think that was quite remarkable. And they've given me a, you know, I think my work ethic has come from watching them and how they have, how they raised us, basically.
Yeah. I was going to say, I can tell from just hearing you, I was going to ask about that sort of entrepreneurial flair, but it's clearly in the blood that you got from your parents. And interestingly, I'm also a middle child, one of three boys, though. So I can relate to the middle child point and definitely on the education side of things as well, something that was instilled in me. But please carry on, because so many things you're saying that just resonate with me.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, people do feel like that, right? Because, you know, that's how you're raised. Either you say that this is what I know and this is what I've built. And it's interesting about the entrepreneurial bit, because when I started my law firm, my parents were not very happy, actually. They were really worried. They said, well, you know, we had to start a business because we came to a country where we weren't established. You know, we hadn't gone through the education system here. And now look at you, you know, you've got a law degree and you've got a really good job. And why on earth would you want to do this and risk it all? So I was really surprised to get that response, that I didn't realize. And so, you know, of course, they backed me, but they were initially apprehensive. But I'd always wanted to be a lawyer. I mean, I went and did some work experience when I was 11 years old, I think. And I went to a practice, a high street practice in Paddington. And I spent 2 days there and I literally just fell in love with the office, the people, the work, everything that was going on. And then I went back and did some work experience with them after that a few times, you know, when I was sort of 16, 17, sort of pre-university. And that really, they were so kind to me. They really, you know, sort of took me under their wing. And that's why I have always in our practice took on work experience students every single year. We make room for two people to come and spend time with us. A little bit tricky during the pandemic, obviously, because I think it's so important, because it's quite life-changing, I think, for a lot of people, you know, that actually cements your desire to do something or teaches you something in any event. So even though we're tiny as a firm, we do make sure that we provide those opportunities, because I have benefited from that opportunity. And then I wanted to be a librarian. If you ask my dad, he'll tell you this, because I thought,
really?
Yeah, because I thought, well, I just love reading. And I thought, well, if I was a librarian, I'd just be able to read all day and get paid for it. And I don't even think I was actually worried about money. I just wanted to read. So luckily, I found a career that allowed me to read all day and also get paid for it. So that's what I wanted to do. But I knew I wanted to do law from my work experience days. And then the question really was, would I study law at university? Because I loved English and I wanted to be a writer and I wanted to be a journalist, actually. And I think sometimes these things go quite well with the law. I think you'll probably find a lot of lawyers who'll say they want to write, or they wanted a career in journalism, something to do with words, really, and sort of history and investigating things and doing all that research stuff that you don't necessarily know that's going to be useful. But I was pragmatic and I thought law, you know, would give me that sort of practical degree and I could write at any point, really. And it was a tough degree. It's supposed to be a difficult subject, and I wanted to do something challenging. And also sort of, you know, I thought, you know, setting English aside and going straight for law, you know, again, going back to that immigrant point, there's an unspoken understanding that there is to be minimal deviation in the pursuit of progress, right? So if you've come somewhere and you are being provided with these opportunities, which we were all fully aware of, then you've got to maximize those opportunities and, you know, not waste any time, really. So that's why I did law. I thought about law with Spanish, because I did Spanish for an A-level, and then that was in Aberdeen, and I'm really a London girl. So I ended up doing my LLB at UCL. And then I graduated, but not having had, you know, mentors in law at all, which is really important. I hadn't really understood the significance of the legal timetable. So this sort of applying for two training contracts 2 years in advance, doing sort of the milk rounds, as they used to call it. So I ended up having to pay for law school because I didn't have a training contract in place. And that was a good thing, actually, because I was really committed to my course. I took a part-time job in retail And although I'm not a morning person, I used to do the 7 a.m. to 11 a.m. shift. And then I went to law school in the afternoon. So I was up very early. And even now, I do not like mornings. I've done many mornings. I've done lots of all-nighters. I've done many mornings. I do lots of different things that require me to wake up early, but I'm not a big fan. And so that's what I did. And then I secured a training contract at Memory Crystal. And so in that year in between that, I had found myself in that position where I had to do something for that year because I hadn't been able to get the training contract immediately. I worked full time as a paralegal at Clifford Chance, and I was in corporate finance technology. And that was a really interesting role because I was hired to teach fee earners, and that's from trainees all the way to partners, how to use an online platform called Books on Screen. So all of these books that you have, you know, Tollies and the Companies Act and all that legislation and other things were on this electronic screen. And it was my job to go from desk to desk, really, and teach that platform. And now looking back on it, I just find it really, you know, it's quite funny because I've always been teaching from the get-go, you know, and now I teach, on the Imperial MBA. So again, it's been sort of something I've developed along the way. And to be able to teach a senior partner at their desk how to use something, it's quite terrifying, actually, being so young. I knew more than they did. So it was great for confidence building as well. And then, I got my training contract at Memory Crystal. They refunded my law school fees, which was, you know, completely unexpected and a great relief. And then I started my training contract. My first seat was in litigation, which I hated. And I hated it because you never got to see the beginning or end of anything. And everything I felt was dismantling things. You know, everyone was trying to break down an argument. And then there was pagination. I still have nightmares about pagination. And then I thought, oh gosh, what if I don't like this? What's going to happen next? And then I went into commercial property and I hated that as well. I thought, I'm done for. And the reason I didn't like that was because it wasn't exciting work. It was quite standardized work. It was leases and licenses. And, you know, I didn't feel challenged enough. And then luckily for me, I ended up in corporate in my third seat and fell madly in love with that seat. And then I asked to do my fourth seat in corporate as well, which they let me do. And I loved it because it was busy. It was fast. It was transactional. There were multiple people involved on the deals. We were floating companies. We had nomads and brokers. We were raising money. I worked really hard, really, really hard. I put in lots of hours, but I didn't mind a bit. And I thought, that's it. This is what I was built to do. So that was my journey in terms of my training contract. And then I was offered a position and I was very happy to accept. And then I said to them, but before I start, I would like a sabbatical. And they said, what? And nobody had ever asked for a sabbatical before. And I had sort of been reading up around this and I could see that people were doing this and taking time off, and I'd not taken any time off. And I wanted to celebrate qualification because it had been a long journey for me. And so they said, how long do you want? And I said, 3 months. And they said, fine. And I thought, oh, I should have asked for longer. And so, and it was such an, I mean, they just said yes. And so then what I did was I booked a flight from London to Hong Kong. London to Singapore. And then from Dubai to London 3 months later. And that was it. I then figured out my plan all the way through those 3 months to bring me back home. And I thought, right, it's my birthday, November the 12th. Where will I be on the world map then? And I thought, Nepal, that is sort of where I might be. What can I do in Nepal? And so I looked at what you could do in Nepal, and you could climb Everest Base Camp. And so I thought, I'm going to do that. And so I spent that birthday blowing my birthday candle out at Everest Base Camp. And I'd planned that entire trip around it. And this was one of the most remarkable things I've ever done in my life, because it gave me that time on my own with a backpack to travel so many different countries, meet so many different people. And then I was able to come back to Memory Crystal and continue with my career then.
What a journey.
Yeah. And I think you just have to be daring, I think.
I always say that, dare to be different and dare to go for it. And I just want to kind of highlight so many learnings that you just shared there. And then we're going to talk more about your firm, because, you know, there's great stories of resilience and work ethic, you know, in terms of, you know, actually getting the training contract. Also the fact that ultimately you'd obviously worked very hard, your fees were refunded, you know, from what you thought librarian to journalist to then landing law, following your passions. And you talked about time, you know, it's our greatest commodity. It's the only thing we never get back. I love that. Mentoring, so, so important. Something we hammer home pretty much on every episode. And then you clearly found your calling and your passion when you found corporate. And it's, you know, you're happy to work hard, you're happy to put in the hours, because it's something that you really, really enjoyed. And the last piece I really liked is around negotiation, because if you don't ask, the answer is always no. Right? You asked and you managed to get that time, and you celebrated successes, you know, big wins, small wins, medium wins, whatever they are, celebrate along the journey. And the fact that you had that magical experience as well as Everest, and you traveled, just so many great learnings in there. So listeners, please go back, rewind that journey. And if you're at that point in your career, there's some real wisdom shared there. But I do want to come on now to talk about your entrepreneurship, because you did found your own firm, Fortune Law, in 2004, I believe, becoming one of the youngest females to start a solo law firm in the UK, which is an incredible feat. And you've touched on lightly, but I'd like to know a little bit more about what really sparked that wanting to start your own law firm. And then maybe for others who might be getting inspired listening to you, you know, what are some of the processes you need to take, you know, high level with that might be helpful for others?
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to start by saying I didn't intend to start a law firm. And so it wasn't something that I set out to do when I set out to be a lawyer. My journey was, you know, what I'd anticipated would happen was that I would qualify as a corporate lawyer. I would then work my way up, and then I would hit the holy grail of equity partnership. Yeah. And because that was really the only pathway at the time. It was you're going to work really hard. And then if somebody says that you're good enough, you're going to start climbing this ladder. Right. And then eventually you're going to be part of the ownership, you know, in the ownership structure of the law firm, and you're going to be respected, and, you know, all of these trappings of whatever that is are going to become yours. And actually, it was never really about money. And so it was really about respect and career development and, you know, what that sort of magic word partner meant at that time. And so I didn't intend to start a law firm, but now looking back, you know, when we talked about sort of entrepreneurialism in the family and so on, I remember when I was at Memory Crystal and I wanted to be promoted, and I had said, right, I know that some of my sort of colleagues who are applying for partnership are creating and producing these business plans, and then they're going to a partners meeting, and then they're presenting these business plans, and then potentially they might get sort of partnership. Right. Well, I'm quite young. You know, I'm sort of 1.5 years qualified, but that's where I want to go. So I produced a business plan without being asked for my next appraisal. And I thought to myself, well, in order to be a partner, you have to bring in business. I mean, that's, you know, the rainmaker is the most important person in the firm. And so I'm going to have to find a way to bring in business as quickly as possible so that people will take me seriously. Anyway, I incorporated a company at Companies House, and it was called First You Dream Limited. And it was because, well, as an entrepreneur, first you dream and then you do, right? So I incorporated this company. I then hired a web developer in Canada who was known to my cousin to build me a website, First You Dream website. And then I started doing a whole bunch of research on entrepreneurs and startups, because I didn't really know anyone at, you know, the big companies, the PLCs that we were acting for. I was looking around my network, you know, who do I know? I don't know Wembley PLC or anything. So who can I bring on as a client? And I knew that there were, you know, young people starting businesses. And I also knew that my friends who were qualified professionals were going into the city to become accountants or lawyers or whatever. And then they were planning to go back into the family business, having qualified, and then run those family businesses and professionalize those businesses further. So I thought, well, that's my network, right? These startups and these people going back into family businesses, that's who are going to be my clients. So I set up this company, and then I did loads of research. There was a big portal at the time called startups.co.uk. And I thought, I'm going to create something like this. And then I didn't realize that startups.co.uk were completely funded by a big bank. And so therefore, all their content was paid for by this huge financial institution. I could not compete with that at all. And so I decided to build a relationship with the Stoy Centre for Family Business, which is a offshoot of BDO Stoy Hayward. And I set up a meeting there to try and run a seminar, family businesses, because I thought, right, I can bring people to this event. Anyway, I took all this information into my business plan that nobody had asked for. And I went to my appraisal with it, and they looked at me and they said, are you sure you want to be a lawyer? And I was devastated. And I said, of course I want to be a lawyer. I want to be a partner. That's why I'm doing all of this. And it was then that I thought, they're not ready for me. They're not ready for me. And they don't understand what I'm doing. And it's going to take a really long time for me to be able to get to do what I want to do. And I'm going to have to wait for someone to say, the time is right for you, or we think you're good enough now. And so with that in mind, and with lots of other things that happens in the city culture and so on, you know, I don't really need to go into detail all of it, but I wasn't really happy about working in that environment. It wasn't the hours. It was never the hours. It was other things. And mainly it was to do with obstacles in my way to progress. And I thought, no, if I quit now and I go and work in another big city law firm, I'm going to have the same problem. I could just foresee it. And I also think I'm going to start afresh. I won't know anybody. Here I've trained for I've worked here for 5.5 years. And if I can't get where I want to get to, where I've been somewhere for 5.5 years, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to make it fast enough somewhere else. So I quit. And then I thought, well, I don't know what else to do because I'm only good for law. What am I going to do now? I only do law. So I thought, I'm going to start a law firm. And I was 3.5 years qualified then. And you have to be 3 years qualified to start a law firm in this country. And so that's what I did. And I didn't have any clients. I didn't have any money, so I decided to take an interim role at Fox Williams, and they hired me to do a Sony Warner joint venture sale of the entertainment group. So I went in as a temp, and I used to do timesheets, you know, And while I was doing that, I started to build my law firm. And so my window seat at home started to build up with files, and I used to get up very early and do networking events and meetings and things. And then I'd go to work every single day at Fox Williams and do my corporate job. And then I got my first flotation, because at Memory Crystal, I used to do IPOs. I floated about 21 companies. And by the time I left, and yeah, the Nomad phoned me up and said, China, we've got a float. Would you be interested? And I said, absolutely, I would. And so that's how I got two floats, actually, in my first year of business, which was, I've still got the admission documents, because it says solicitors to the placing Fortune Law. And that was quite magnificent, you know, for me to say, here's my little law firm of just me working on this IPO, and then two IPOs all by myself before I even had anyone to help me or an office or anything, just me and my kitchen table. And so that was fantastic. And I then thought to myself, all right, I'm going to go full time. It was always the intention that in September I would give up my job at Fox Williams and then go full time. And every week they kept saying, can you stay forever? And every week I would say, oh, no, I don't want to. And every week they would offer me more money. And every week I would say, it's not about the money. But I was just a bit scared to say to them, I'm going to start my own law firm, because I thought they might be cross, you know, because I was sort of doing it in my spare time. And then I thought, I need an office. And I was a trustee at the time of the African Environmental Film Foundation, which was a job that was given to me while I was working at Memory Crystal. I was just asked to set up the charity. And that's something that's really important. Always say yes to things, because you just never know where that's going to take you. So the partner there, the senior partner, said, can you set up this charity? And I thought, God, I don't know how to set up a charity, but I'm going to find out. So off I went. And it was like a pro bono piece of work. So I didn't get to put it on my timesheet, or it didn't, you know, count towards my bonus or anything, but it was work I did that I was asked to do and I found interesting. I thought, I'm going to do really well here. And then I built the relationship with Simon Trevor, actually, who is an award-winning film director who started the charity. You know, we had Sigourney Weaver. She did the narration on these films, you know, African issues and animals and conservation and so on. And so we basically built this relationship. And then I was asked to come out to Africa, and I went and stayed in Tsavo National Park, you know, in this little hut, really. It was a hut, it's a house, you know, it's a proper house, but it's on the outskirts. Richard Leakey, the cabinet minister of Kenya, had allowed Simon to build this place. So I went to stay out there, you know, for a week, just living in the national park. And it's all these things that come from this. And one of the tax partners was also a trustee on the charity. So when I started up at Fortune Law, I went to see him to give him back the checkbooks and things that I had. And he said, what are you doing, Shino? I said, I'm looking for an office. And he said, oh, you should go and see my mate, Teja Picton Howell of Picton Howell Solicitors. And I said, all right, why is that? And he said, well, you know, he's got a law firm in Lincoln's Inn Fields. He might be able to help you. So off I trotted to see Teja. And he said, look, I can rent you an office in my offices. And I said, oh, right. And he said, look, you can have access to the library and all of these things. And I said, that sounds very nice. I said, how much will that cost me? And he went with his calculator, and he came up with, I can't remember the thing. And we still laugh about this, Teja and I, when we meet for lunch so many years later. And he said, I don't know, £15,000 or something, or 20, or I can't remember. But and I looked at him and I thought, but I don't know if I'm going to make that money this year. So how could I underwrite that liability? And so away I went, thinking, no, I can't afford that. But it sparked this idea in me to find a law firm to share offices with. And I thought, right, well, if he's willing to rent out offices to me, something I'd never heard of, maybe there will be other law firms who are willing to do this. So I did a lot of research and I came up with 8 or 9 law firms that I thought I'd have a really good fit with. They were not massive, but they didn't, either they didn't have a corporate department, or they didn't have any, they had a corporate department, but no listed company experience. And I thought, well, I could be a good fit with these guys. So I wrote a very cheeky letter, and I wrote to the senior partner of each one of these law firms. And I said, sorry for writing to you cold, but if the contents of this letter don't appeal, at least you can make a paper airplane out of it. I swear that is what I wrote. And all of the 8 or 9 senior partners wrote to me and invited me in for an interview. So I went to see them, and some of them, I thought, they're a bit stuffy, it won't work. Some of them were a bit new. And then I settled on Jeffrey Green Russell. And I did that because I met the senior partner, Tony Coles, and I met the head of corporate, John. And I got on with them like a house on fire. And I was doing these meetings in my lunch hour, right? So I would leave everything behind. And then I would turn up at these meetings with my phone and my phone back to the office. And so I told Fox Williams, I'm leaving and I'm starting a law firm. And they said, start your law firm from here. And I said, what? And they said, yeah, well, we'll also rent you office space. And I said, can I have my name on the door? And they said, yes. And I said, well, can I have access to the library? And they said, yes. And I said, can I have access to secretarial support? And they said, yes. And they said yes to everything that I had negotiated at Jeffrey Green Russell. And I said, let me have a think about it. And I didn't sleep all night. And then I went back the next morning and I said, I'm terribly sorry. You know, it's a great offer, but I've come in here as a temp, and so I'm not sure you're going to be able to bridge that gap. And I don't think we can cross refer because you've got clients like Sony and Warner, and most importantly, I shook hands with these two yesterday, and so I'm going to go with them. And he said, "Oh, why? Wish you told me that earlier, because they've just gone into a partners meeting to vote on this." And I said, "Well, you shouldn't have let them go in to talk about that when I hadn't talked to you." But on my exit, which was very amicable, Tina Williams of Fox Williams called me to her office and she said, I've heard some great things about you from everyone I've spoken to. I know we haven't worked together. She said, I've got a job. It's a partnership dispute because she's a top partnership lawyer in the city. And I'm conflicted, she said. And Farrow & Co. on the other side. Do you want to take it with you? And I said, Absolutely. And I thought, wow, isn't that remarkable that, you know, she's not worked with me, but she's watched, she's heard, and she's wanted to help me, someone she doesn't really know who's just about to launch a law firm. And so I took that job with me, and I managed to negotiate a very good settlement for my client with James, who was at Barron Co. partner there. So that was my Fox Williams, you know, journey. And then I went and moved into offices with Jeffrey Green Russell, 56 New Bond Street. Not a bad place to start your first law firm.
No.
Office. So we had Fortune Law on the door between Fenix and Dolce & Gabbana. And there we were with our sign, 56 New Bond Street. And I had a great time there. I was really well supported by the team, who let me, you know, come to events, you know, Christmas parties, took me under their wing, you know, really supported me. And then when I grew up a little bit more and moved into my own offices near Oxford Circus, they even sent me a boardroom table and furniture. And one of the partners sent me my first brand new carpet for the new office. And they were just really super kind. And, you know, I found that along the way, people have been so kind to me in my journey. And I'll never forget, you know, the things that people who are senior to me in our profession have done for me.
Yeah, I'm just loving listening to that whole journey and story. And there's so many things to unpack. You know, I love, you know, I talk about this a lot, you know, reputation, you know, reputations carry a long way. And the fact that, you know, Tina Williams invited you and had heard you'd built a reputation off the back of the hard work you'd done, and that led to, you know, getting that case and, you know, spearheading on. And, you know, even just listening to your way, the way you think, even to that business plan where you're trying to, you know, understand your ICA, what would be that ideal customer avatar you would be targeting if you were going into it. And a really big learn that you shared is sometimes you will outgrow an environment. And unless you are willing to move out of that environment or create a new one, you will end up getting into a space of probably not feeling comfortable or being unhappy, negative. And I love that you kind of always look forward, you back yourself. There's so much self-belief. There's so much wisdom shared in there. And obviously networking comes, you know, naturally to you. And I love the point about cheekiness in negotiation, because, you know, you don't get what you deserve in this life. You get what you negotiate. And the fact that you were very cheeky and you put some humorous, and you know, you're going to get those responses. So, you know, maybe you're a trainee, maybe you're thinking of starting a law firm, maybe you have, there's so much you can learn from what has just been shared. So again, go back, rewind, listen to that story. There's so many passings of wisdom in that. Thank you so much for sharing. So let's talk more about Fortune Law, because I think it's amazing the type of work you've done, what you've built up, you know, the awards, you're very well sort of recognized and established. But for those that might be less familiar, could you sort of tell us more and maybe comparisons to other types of boutique law firms and why, in your words, you feel you stand out? Because law's competitive and the legal service market is competitive. Time for a short break from the show. Are you looking for a way to get your firm working more efficiently and profitably while ensuring a better work-life balance for your team? Well, if you haven't considered our sponsor, Clio, I'm here to strongly recommend that you do. I absolutely love working with Clio. Not only is it the world's leading legal practice management and legal client relationship management software, it also has a really solid core mission to transform the legal experience for all, something I personally support. What sets Clio apart for me, it's their dedication to customer success and support. There are lots of legal softwares out there, but I know from talking to Clio users that their support offering is miles ahead of the rest, with their 24/5 availability via email, in-app chat, and over the phone. Yes, you can actually call in and speak to someone. Clio is also the G2 crowd leader in legal practice management in comparison to 130 legal practice management softwares, and has been for the last 14 consecutive quarters. G2 Crowd is the world's leading business solutions review website. You can check Clio's full list of features and pricing at www.clio.com/legally-speaking. That's www.clio.com/legally-speaking. Now back to the show.
Yeah, I have a client. I mean, When I was nominated for one of these awards, I had to get some testimonials. Obviously, Tina Williams gave me a stonking testimonial, video testimonial, and then I got some others. And one of my clients said, "I mean, to think, really, to start a law firm in one of the most competitive cities in the world, like, you know, that sort of takes some guts." But I think it was just because I was in law and because I wanted to do things a certain way. And I think that, you know, you do need to back yourself. I think that's probably one of the most important things in the world. And I hope I've got two sons. I hope they understand and rely on backing themselves too, because I think that's really important, that you've got to stand up and be counted, and also you've got to deliver, right? You can't just talk. You've got to deliver. And so I think sort of it is a competitive environment, but I didn't really want to start a law firm and not do excellent work. So in my mind, I am used to, or I was used to, doing a particular type of work at a particular level with a particular amount of detail. And Memory Crystal, you know, I worked really hard, but they gave me opportunities during that period, which I'm eternally grateful for, because yes, they didn't give me the promotion I wanted at the time I wanted it. And I know I'm really impatient. I know that about myself. And also, you know, there is a place for every law firm that's in the system. You know, there big law has its place, boutique law firms have their place, and everyone is there doing something, you know, depending on how, you know, I've got friends who are partners in big law and are really happy, you know, for the type of work they're doing, the you know, where they've worked hard and they've got to a particular place. So I don't think that, you know, I think there's a space for everyone. And then the question really is, what do you want to do? And I want to do high quality work, and I want to do it in an autonomous way. And therefore, I had to make sure that I got really high quality work, because otherwise I would not have been deeply unhappy. And so that's really the focus of what we did. So I started off the firm thinking, I'm going to float companies, because that's what I did. And so I realized that actually I did get these two floats in year one. And I thought, right, that's it. This is what I'm going to do. I'm just going to carry on floating companies. And then guess what, Rob? That work stopped, because it's quid pro quo. So unless you have a client that wants to float, and you can give that to the nomad or the broker or the reporting accountant, you're not going to get anything back. And I realize at that point, I'm very young and I do not have that client base, and I cannot give that work back. And if I can't reciprocate, then it's not going to come to me. So unless I go and find all these clients and nurture them to a point that they're going to float, I have better find something else to do. And so that's what I did. I realized that actually I cannot build a client base on IPO work. And so I decided to change tack and then started Acting for Entrepreneurs. And actually, those are like my favorite people anyway, because I've done some big ticket work, you know, and, you know, it's always a board of directors. And so it really depends on who your relationship with is on the board. But for the most part, you know, entrepreneurs are literally the reason I wake up in the morning. So this is why our business has evolved from corporate finance only to turning our attention to entrepreneurs. And I won't say to you, oh, because it's an underserved part of the market and all of the other things that people might say as they target a particular market. It's really that I had to build a business around people that I really wanted to represent. And so that's why we are different from some boutique law firms who only focus on one specialization, right? So you'll get an employment boutique or a tax boutique or an immigration boutique. You can't really do that as a COCO lawyer, because being a COCO lawyer, you've got to get involved in everything else, right? You're buying a business, there's due diligence, there's commercial leases, there's employment contracts, there's negotiating service agreements, there's IP that's got to be form part of the SPA. So you can't really cut yourself off as a COCO lawyer, which meant, what did I have to do? I had to learn how to deliver the rest of it really well. So I had to build a system. And so how did I build my system? Well, I started off, do you know James Knight from Keystone? I don't know if you know him, but he's...
I do know of him, James, yes.
Yeah. So he founded Keystone round about the time I founded Fortune Law. Look where he is, right? But at the time, James used to answer the telephone himself. He used to send out letters of engagement himself. So I'd phone him up, James, I've got this commercial lease now. I need a commercial property lawyer. And he would say, all right, I'm sending you so-and-so. And so that's how we did it. So we built a business around using consultants to provide the add-on service that we needed as a commercial company outfit. And so that's what I did. I learned a lot of things. And litigation, so half my work is corporate and the other half is litigation. And that's really, I mean, I'm as fascinated as anyone else by this because I hated my first seat. But equally, I was able to secure a really big piece of work from a massive American law firm. And I didn't have litigation expertise. And so I hired it in. And when we got to the tail end of this piece of work, the litigator had moved on to Pastures New. And so I went back to counsel and I said, listen, Robert, I said, where do you want me to transfer this file to? Because obviously I'm not a litigator. And he said, no. He said, we're almost at the tail end. He said, we'll do it together. I said, but I don't know how to do litigation. He said, I will teach you. And so that's how I did my first proper piece of litigation, big high court claim. You know, it was a company law issue. It was fiduciary duties and so on. So it wasn't an area of law I didn't understand. So we did that. And then when my next big piece of litigation came in, this was a high court case that was published, actually. It was an American sort of company on the other side of us. And I phoned Robert and I said, I've got a really big piece of litigation. I said, which law firm shall I send it to so they can instruct you? And he said, no. He said, we'll do it together. And that's what we did. So Robert Deacon, he used to be at 11 Stone Buildings, you know, he taught me along the way. And so that's really how I've developed, with using incredible expertise, not straying out of my lane, but not being scared of learning new things, as long as my clients' interests are protected, because that's the overriding duty. So that's really how we've developed a practice, using expertise and drawing it in. And, you know, I know people like to specialize only in one area. And we've had lawyers who've come to work with us who say, I'm only doing corporate shine law. And I'm like, that's absolutely fine. I'm the one who's a sort of a, you know, slight maverick in that regard. But I look at it akin to, you know, what general counsel does in a business. You know, they have to have a certain degree of business knowledge over a number of areas, and then they hire in the expertise. And really, my clients love that. They say, look, we just come to you. You're the fixer and you'll get us the best people. And so we're able to do really complex, global, you know, international work for our clients because of being able to see the bigger picture and, you know, being able to make sure that we've built the right team around us. And I think that's really, I think that's what makes us stand out and why our clients keep coming back and trusting us with really big ticket work.
Yeah, and it's incredible what, you know, the types of work you have done over the years. You know, you've advised Future Medical PLC, Company Health Group PLC, World Trade Systems PLC, listed on the London Stock Exchange. The list goes on and on and on. And there's so many learnings, again, that you shared when it comes to your entrepreneurial journey. What really struck me was, what do you want to do? You know, you have to figure that out, because to have that passion, that flame, that fire in your belly, it really needs to understand, don't just start another law firm, but what is it that you want to do, that real why? And again, the fact that you aren't scared to pivot. I love that you talk about evolution, because business plans are great and they all get written up. But I can tell you, if you look at your business plan day one, so whenever you exit or finish your business, it'll look exceptionally different, because the only constant in business is change. And I love the fact that you were kind of open-minded. You just have an open-minded growth mindset. I love that you talk about systems, networking. And again, just listening to your stories, you've leveraged your networks, you've collaborated, you've been connected to great people, and it's just allowed your firm to flourish. And again, really important, you talk about client care and trust. So loving this conversation. And I do want to talk about some of your wider interests as well, because you do so much. And I think it's really important Again, I know something you've done a lot of is sales marketing. You do a lot of TV, media work, etc. But you also find time to give back. And you've talked a bit about teachings from people that have taught you, but you teach, and I mentioned in the introduction as well, you teach law for entrepreneurs course for an executive MBA. So I'd love for you to tell us more about your work and what that course involves over at Imperial College.
Yeah, you're right. You've got to know what it is you want to do. And so my client base, I mean, my clients are the most important thing, apart, you know, my team and my client base.
Yeah.
So when I saw people coming to us, you know, when you start working for entrepreneurs, you realize that they're really quite exposed. Yeah. Because they don't know what they don't know, and they've got limited budget, and they're starting to build something which is all consuming. So it's very hard to then for them to balance out and have a sensible business plan and have a legal budget and all of these things. So I find a lot of people don't really know how much legal costs are likely to be. They just assume it's not going to be nice, and they don't even ask the question. So I kept getting people coming into my office, and I thought, you know what? I just want to educate them. I want to educate them that they need to have these things in place. They need to have a legal budget and budget for it, even if they don't use it in a particular year. Just set it aside, right? Investors like that too, because they know that, you know, you've thought about risk. And so I thought, well, if they're not coming to me until it's too late, then I will find a way to go to them. And so I devised a whole day workshop, a 7-hour course for entrepreneurs, and it was our legal boot camp. And I promoted it on LinkedIn. And what happened was there was a really nice chap who was on the Imperial Executive MBA, who also was a qualified lawyer, done the New York bar exam. And he contacted me on LinkedIn, and he said, we don't get taught law on my Imperial MBA program. I think there's a gap. And so I said, come and see me. And then we went and did a walk and talk, because I like walking meetings where possible. And we talked about how we might address this gap on the MBA. And so we held a focus group, and we spoke to students on the MBA program who really said, we need something super basic. You know, the vast majority of us have never started a company. And so what we did was I took that course, I created from the bootcamp a different course that was tailored. And then we went and pitched it to Imperial. And it took a while. It took a while because you get caught up in bureaucracy. So you've got to be determined, and you've got to be persistent, and you've got to keep at it. And eventually I got a meeting with Dr. Marcus Perkman at Imperial. And in 20 minutes, we shook hands and we decided, right, that's it. This is what we're going to do. And it's going to be part of their entrepreneurial journey program. And so I ran a pilot. So I went into the lecture theater. I ran a pilot. It went so well. They said, please teach it. I ran, my first one was in during the pandemic, so it was an online lesson. It was 90 minutes, and then I did two of those. I did one hybrid lecture, and then they said, look, we're getting such great feedback. Can you turn your 90 minutes into a 4-hour workshop? And so that's what I now teach. And the feedback is incredible. I usually run an impromptu clinic at the end because everybody comes with questions. And, you know, it's, yeah. I love teaching, and so this is sort of highlight of my calendar, really, teaching at Imperial. And so yeah, and that really came, you know, people think when they see these things that it's just these things just happen. They don't just happen, right? It comes from an idea, a desire to do something. Sometimes it's to do something different. And then you've got to commit to it. And then you've got to keep, and you have got to invest your own time and resources into building something. And only then will some form of luck come along, some door will be opened, and then it will take you to where you are intending to go. But none of this happens without you being decisive about what it is you want to do. And again, going back to that point, it's not usually about the money. It's about wanting to build something, right? And then all the other things come afterwards. But at any stage of this process, I could have said, right, well, I don't really know this chap. I don't really know. It's not really my plan to go to a university and teach my course. it's not really my plan to do these things. And, you know, or they're not really paying attention, so I'll let it go and start something else. You've got to be persistent about this thing. And then look, and then amazing things happen, and amazing things come from the back of that thing.
Yeah, it's amazing how that snowball effect can happen. And I just want to kind of echo what you're saying. I always say initially, passion over profits, because the profits will come if you lead with your passion. And you're absolutely echoing that. And people talk about ideas. Ideas aren't actually great. Taking action is better. You know, you can have this best, so many ideas stay at that idea stage. Take action, learn along the way. The mistakes will make you get better over time. And people always say knowledge is power. Knowledge is absolutely not power. Applied knowledge is power. Yeah. Taking that action. And I love that, you know, I could see that you love giving back, because, you know, you've got so much from mentors and teaching, and, you know, I just hear the passion of you teaching and wanting to help others and the next generation of entrepreneurs. It's lovely, because we need more kindness in the world. Like you said, you've been lucky to be surrounded by lots of kind people that have helped you. And it's great, because that sparks the next generation and the next generation of kind people. And certainly my mission with what I'm trying to do to sort of build this wider global legal community of kindness collaboration is everything. So that's one sort of string to your additional bow on top of everything else you do. But you also have a very important role, and I know you've had a busy weekend that just gone by, but you're also a board member of His Highness Agna Khan International Conciliation and Arbitration. So can you tell us more about that and what responsibilities you have there?
Yeah, I'd love to. So this is, again, this is the culmination at the moment of a long journey of service. So I have been brought up, my community, my family, which is service to others. And so this is just part and parcel of how I've been raised. And I don't really think about it. And then I think that sort of translates into your day-to-day life, your work, and so on. And I know I'm not alone in holding this principle dear to me. And I also think, you know, lawyers are really good at this, actually, because, you know, we do a lot of pro bono work. And I think our profession is also, you know, helps structure ourselves in a way that we can do good and give back. So I really love this role. I sit on the international board. This is my seventh year of sitting on this board. And prior to that, I sat on the national board for the United Kingdom. And I did that for 6 or also 7 years, because I think we had an extension. And so I was appointed onto the national board a week before my wedding. So I wasn't really able to celebrate with everyone else because I had my hen do. And so I went for my oath ceremony and then said, I'm really sorry, I can't come to the barbecue because I've got all these women waiting for me to for my hen do. And then I got married, and then we were very blessed to have our baby, Rafe, 9 months later. So my children have never known anything apart from me being on the national board or the international board. And that is a big commitment. So on the national board, we mediate disputes. And I was on the board for being the commercial lawyer that would handle disputes within the community on a pro bono basis to avoid people having to go to court and try to resolve things. You know, so I then became an accredited mediator. So that's when how I became a mediator, which actually really helps me with my dispute resolution work. And then after 6 or 7 years of doing that, having both my children, second term, I was given a lot of project work because I had a young family. So it was a lot of drafting, you know, sort of did a lot of work with international organizations and NGOs. And then I was appointed to the international board, which means I represent the United Kingdom, France, and Portugal. And so they have national boards, and my role is to act as liaison. And then at board level, there are 9 of us to avoid there being, you know, deadlock in decision making. And so I have colleagues from America. We have in Kenya, Court of Appeal judge. My colleague from the States is a partner at Gibson Dunn. Then we've got a KC in Canada. Our chair, she is the general counsel, a big organization in Vancouver. Then we have members from Pakistan, also a lawyer from partner in a law firm, India, Syria, and Tajikistan. So we basically have 19 jurisdictions represented between us, and we are there to manage international disputes, deal with training of all the volunteers around the world. It's a massive training program. We work with CEDA, and so we have hired CEDA, who basically is our official training partner, to train everybody around the world. And then we write policy. So one of my projects at the moment is drafting a code of conduct policy to deal with how all of the volunteers around the world, and it's all got to be translated in different languages. So, you know, we've got to deal with it very carefully, you know, manage their responsibilities, ethics behind the work that we do, and so on. And so, and we also deal with disciplinary matters. And we're running an arbitration pilot program in the States at the moment. So it's a lot of work. We meet three times a year, except for the pandemic, we haven't. So our next meeting will be in Toronto in September. And we've met in India and Lisbon and Dubai and so on. And we do, yeah, we have a monthly meeting, and we have a lot of work that we do behind the scenes, a lot of drafting, and being sort of completely aware of what's going on in all the jurisdictions around the world and what's impacting. You know, for example, Pakistan's got serious issues at the minute, you know, inflation and so on. How do we deal with the community there? How do we support the community there? You'll have different issues in different jurisdictions. Syria is in a particularly dark place right now. What's happening with the US elections that are coming? You know, so we've got to be on the ball to understanding what's happening. You know, we've got an influx of, you know, sort of migration in the EU at the moment. And how do we deal with displacement of people? What do we put in place for that? So it's a privilege. It's a massive privilege. And so Friday, Saturday and Sunday just gone, I have been in boardroom for longer than I would like to do on a weekend. But it's really important work. And I'm honored to be able to participate in doing that work for my community and for the wider community as well.
Yeah, and like, as you say, it's very meaningful, purposeful work. And, you know, there's also some great things you mentioned there in terms of it teaches you new skills, you know, that actually can help, you know, with your wider sort of law firm practice and skill set. And the fact that you meet these global, you know, networks, and you get to go to all of these different sort of international environments and meet people, I think it's fantastic. Shana, this has been an incredible discussion. So many learns about your career journey into the law and, you know, your personal story, and then obviously Fortune Law, and lots of cheekiness and negotiation. And, you know, it's going to be quite a hard question for you to answer this, but I just want that one piece of advice you would say to somebody who's interested in a career in the law. What would be your one piece of advice to them?
Oh, one piece of advice. Golly, I've got so many different things. I mean, if I only have to choose one, I'd probably say don't take shortcuts. And when I say don't take shortcuts, I don't mean don't work smart, right? You know, obviously there's work hard and there's work smart. And to leverage everything that's around you to be able to get you to where you need to get to faster is a great thing. But I think being a thoughtful person, being a considered person is really important. So, you know, when you go, when I used to have appraisals, one of the boxes that they would need you to tick was critical use of precedence, right? And what does that mean? It basically means don't just take what's in front of you, right? And then just apply what's in front of you. Think about it. Think about it. And I feel that the only way that you could be a thoughtful person, a considered person, is if you don't take shortcuts. Read widely, understand context, spend time on lifelong learning. So work smart, but don't take shortcuts.
Really good piece of advice. And, you know, what I always say to people is to sort of build on that and to echo what you said, is invest in yourself, invest that time to be excellent at something, or to, you know, like you say, absolutely be working smart, leverage technology, you know, AI is everywhere, etc., etc. But don't just take a shortcut, because ultimately, you know, to get the best clients, to get the best work, they want that excellent individual and someone who stays curious, open to learning, you know, stays up with the time, all of the amazing things that you've mentioned. Yes. So thank you so much for sharing that. So if our listeners, which I'm absolutely sure they will, would like to learn more about Fortune Law, or also your Law for Entrepreneurs clause on the Executive MBA, or the International Conciliation, the Arbitration Board, and everything else you do, where can they find out more? What's the best platform or way for them to get in touch?
So LinkedIn's a great platform. So obviously, like everybody else, I'm on LinkedIn. So you could find me there. Our website at www.fortunelaw.com. And on there, there's an inquiry form. And so you can, you know, put in your details if you wanted to sign up for our waitlist for our next masterclass. And also then CEDARS, actually, I do a lot of work with CEDARS. And so if you type in my name and Cedars, you'll come up with all the free courses, all the free webinars that I've done for entrepreneurs. And that's got, you know, everything from FSMA to shareholders agreements to corporate responsibilities and directors' duties. And they're all free to download. So that would probably be a good place to start, at least.
Absolutely. And that's, again, how Community Spirit, giving free resources, helping people, sharing knowledge. Absolutely brilliant. Thank you so, so much, Anna. I've really, really enjoyed having you on the show. I would like to wish you lots of continued success with your entrepreneurial pursuits and everything else that you're getting up to. But from all of us on the Legally Speaking podcast, for now, over and out. Thank you for listening to this week's episode. If you like the content here, why not check out our world-leading content and collaboration hub, the Legally Speaking Club, over on Discord. Go to our website, www.legallyspeakingpodcast.com, for the link to join our community there. Over and out.